All right, we're back on the record in the Theory 2 general causation case and the Mead and King cases, and I see Dr. Lord is on the witness stand. Ma'am, if you would raise your right hand. You swear or affirm that the evidence you shall give in the case now and herein should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
Thank you. You may proceed, government.
Good morning, Dr. Lord.
Good morning.
Would you please state your name for the record?
Catherine Lord.
And would you please state what your current position is?
I am the director of the University of Michigan Autism and Communication Disorders Clinic and a professor at University of Michigan.
And would you please briefly describe your educational background since high school?
I have a bachelor's degree in psychology from UCLA. I then went to graduate school at Harvard and graduated from a program in psychology and social relations. I was an intern at the University of North Carolina, and I guess that's it.
Was that a postdoctoral decision? At UNC?
Yeah.
And do you hold any board certifications?
I'm an ABPP, which is the American Board of Professional Psychologists in Clinical Psychology, and am part of the National Health Register for Clinical Psychologists.
And do you hold any licenses?
I'm licensed in Michigan and Illinois.
In what discipline?
In clinical psychology.
And would you please briefly describe your academic employment history?
My first position was at University of Minnesota, where I was a professor, assistant professor in child development. I then went to Canada, to University of Alberta, with my husband, and then moved back to North Carolina to set up a clinic at University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, then went to University of Chicago, and am now at University of Michigan.
And now you're a member of any professional societies or organizations in your discipline?
I'm a member of INSAR, the International Organization for Autism Research.
Is that formerly called IMFAR?
Yeah. Okay. SRCD, the Society for Research in Child Development, APA, American Psychological Association. That's probably the main ones.
And have you been honored for your work in autism specifically?
Yes. I received an award from the Royal Academy of Psychiatry in the UK, an award from the California State. I was the chair of a National Academy of Sciences committee looking at the effectiveness of early intervention in autism.
Now, your report states that you're one of four scientists who make up the Strategic Planning Committee for Autism Research for the National Institutes of Health. What does that entail?
As part of the Combating Autism Act, there was a committee created, or there was the statement that there should be a committee created to plan how NIH and the other agencies in the federal government would allocate funding, not specifically for grants, but to set priorities in terms of research and federal funding. So the federal government invited four scientists as well as community members, people representing different kinds of practice and families to create a committee to try to set these goals.
Were you appointed to that committee?
Yes.
Now, your report also states that you are on the Planning Committee for Autism and Related Diagnoses for the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders 5. Is that correct?
That's right.
Is that also known as the DSM?
Yes.
And is that an appointed position?
Yes.
How many people are working on that planning committee?
On the committee that I am a member of, there's probably 12. I think there are 12 different people.
And what does working on that planning committee entail?
Conference calls and meetings, but the goal is to try to create the framework and then test the framework that will be used for diagnoses of autism spectrum disorders and other developmental disorders in the next round of DSM-5, which is the organization that's used in the U.S. for billing for children, which obviously has a huge effect on health insurance and the ways in which kids are covered.
Were you also involved in the formulation of the DSM-4?
Yes.
In what capacity?
I was a member of that committee, and then our group received funding from NIH and also the American Psychiatric Association to try to test out when we proposed criteria to see whether they would really work and how well clinicians could use them.
Do you hold any teaching positions in your specialty? I believe you touched on that earlier.
Yeah, I teach at University of Michigan.
Are you a full professor?
Yes.
And what do you teach?
I teach assessment. I run training workshops in diagnosis. I teach developmental psychopathology research design.
And who are you teaching?
I'm teaching mostly graduate students, although I supervise undergraduates in practical placements with regard to autism and research.
And how long have you been teaching?
My first teaching job was in 1976, so 32 years.
Do you give lectures to professional groups or organizations specifically about autism and autism spectrum disorders?
Yes, I do.
To whom do you lecture?
Grand rounds at medical schools, conferences, parents groups, professional groups that want training in diagnosis or information about longitudinal studies, sort of looking at outcome and how kids change over time.
And how often do you lecture?
I try to not do it more than once a month, but it probably ends up being more like 20 times a year.
Do you lecture internationally as well as domestically? And you mentioned that you lecture to family groups. Do you devote time to family-based associations dealing with autism?
Yes. I mean, I feel like for a long time we've tried to work with family groups because ultimately the parents are the people who are most responsible for these kids. So in Michigan, I work with a number of parent groups. I've also had a long-standing affiliation with a group, several groups in Chicago, but one group in particular that designs wraparound services, that services after school for kids with autism and adults.
I'd like to talk about your clinical experience as a clinical psychologist over the past 30 years, specifically as it relates to autism spectrum disorders. Do you currently have a clinical practice?
Yes.
Could you describe your practice?
I usually see one myself. I work working with one other person and a child psychiatrist. I see one new child coming up for a diagnosis a week, which is about a 10-hour assessment plus a school visit. And then I also supervise a clinic with another five PhDs and a speech pathologist and a social worker, and each of them often sees a couple of other new kids, as well as we follow up the kids that we've seen before.
And are you affiliated with a hospital?
Yes.
Which one?
Yeah, University of Michigan.
So you mentioned that you diagnose and currently treat children with autism?
Yes.
And you say approximately one per week?
That's right. I might see five new kids a week because I see kids that other people are seeing as their primary assessment too, but I do the primary work for one child.
If you were to approximate how many children you've diagnosed with autism throughout the course of your career, what would be the number?
I think the number I came up with was about 4,000 when you count kids that not only that I've seen, done all the work for, but where I've supervised other people in the work and actually met the child.
And does that also include part of your research?
Yes.
You're diagnosing children with autism. Are you currently following adults as well who have autism?
Yes. Yeah.
When you see a child with autism, do you follow him or her into adolescence?
Yeah, our goal when we do assessments is to be available to follow that child as, you know, or adult, as long as we can be helpful. So we have adult services in our clinic, and I still know adults that I met when they were two.
What are the age ranges of your patients currently?
Right now, we have a toddler clinic, which goes down to 12 months, although most of the kids aren't really that little, and all the way up through we have adult social groups and adult treatment programs that go up. We have a 50-year-old, actually a 56-year-old in those.
And do you meet with parents also as part of your clinical practice?
Yes. I mean, parents are involved
in
every
what capacity?
Step of the way. So we... part of our diagnosis is talking to parents about what their child is like at home and also in other circumstances, how their child has changed, what the parents have done, what the parents are worried about, trying to figure out what we can help, and also so that we're not making recommendations that just tell parents to do things that they've already done. So we do almost everything that we do, unless an adult with autism prefers not to have their parents there, we do either with parents right in the room with us or parents watching through an observation room.
Do you also have a research practice?
Yes.
Could you please describe your practice, your research practice?
We have a number of major research projects going on at the time. We're involved in two early intervention projects where the idea is to identify children as young as possible who are at high risk for autism. And one is a sort of low-intensity intervention where parents do most of the work, and we're trying to support parents and teach them things that will be helpful. Another is a much more high-intensity intervention where we provide people that go into the home and do 20 hours a week of work with these very small children. Both of these are randomized control trials, so there's a community alternative, and then we've developed something just so families don't get nothing who are not randomized into the main treatment, which involves parent education and a toddler group. We also have a longitudinal study where we followed children who were referred at age 2 for possible autism. There are two groups of kids, a group in North Carolina, which I saw when I was there, and a group in Chicago, which I saw when I was there. We've followed those kids. They're now 16 to 19 years old, and so we are actually just preparing to see them again. We saw them at 2, 3, 5, and 9, and then have had parents on the phone and filling out forms for us every 3 months in the meantime while we tried to get money to see the kids. We're involved in a development of an instrument that will measure spontaneous communication. There are a lot of tests that measure vocabulary and children's ability to name things, but not a lot of good ways to look at how well kids can actually communicate. So we're trying to build on the diagnostic measures that we've created to do that, and are moving through the development of an instrument to do that. We're the leaders of a big genetics consortium. Even though I'm not a geneticist, but my job is really to help the geneticists define what is autism, figure out ways we can quantify different aspects of autism, that is, figure out how severe a social deficit is, how severe a language deficit is, and have that information available to researchers. And this is a public repository, so researchers will be able to apply to get access to this, to do studies of different genetic hypotheses, but also recruiting families into this program so that as we find things, not just genetic, we can go back and ask families, do you want to be part of this neuroimaging study because there's a finding that might be relevant to your child. I think those are the main, and we've just completed development of a toddler module where we are trying to figure out if we can diagnose autism in children as young as 12 to 18 months. How would you do it? How can you convey this and teach other people to do this given all the limitations and concerns about overdiagnosing little kids?
How long have you been researching autism?
I started working in an autism research project as an undergraduate, so in 1969. And then in graduate school, did other things and then circled back to autism when I was in North Carolina. So it's been, if you count undergraduate, it's almost 40 years.
As part of your research practice, do you research the phenomenon of regression in autism?
Yes.
And how long have you been researching regression in autism?
Well, we have been keeping track and trying to, in a very gross way, define regression since we began to develop the standardized diagnostic instruments. So that occurred in the early 80s. And then I think I became more interested in, with what does this mean, and also more concerned that sometimes people were implying that regression didn't exist. And so began trying to organize various groups that I was involved in to try to get enough subjects so that we could actually look at whether we can answer, is regression a figment of parents' imagination, which I don't think it is, but and then how can we better understand it? So I was involved in a series of relatively large, some small scale and then larger scale studies looking at the prevalence of regression. And then most recently, we've been studying these very young children who are either siblings of children with autism or whom somebody has a reason to think that they might have high risk for having autism down to, you know, infants. And one of the reasons we did that was because we were interested in whether if we saw kids regularly at very young ages, we might actually see the regression occurring and would have a better sense of what was actually happening.
And how often are you seeing these children?
Once a month.
And how long has that research been ongoing?
That study has been going on now, I think, for about 3 years.
Now, you'd mentioned that you were one of the authors of the Autism Diagnostic Interview. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is the acronym ADIR?
Mm-hmm.
What does the R stand for, revised?
Revised, yep.
Who are the other authors on that?
Michael Rutter and Ann Lacuda.
And could you describe what that is and how it's used?
The ADIR is a long, semi-structured interview, which means that rather than asking people yes-no questions, you ask the caregivers, usually parents, to describe specific contexts in which they have observed their child. So the idea is that you really use the parents' knowledge as a window into looking for specific behaviors in children. And then the examiner uses that information to try to apply what the parents have said to specific criteria that would say, yes, this child, for example, has difficulties in eye contact, or this child has unusual facial expression. So rather than asking a parent, does your child have unusual facial expressions, the idea is to get the parent to talk about facial expressions and then to actually code that information.
And who uses the ADIR?
The ADIR is used around the world, primarily in research. It's been translated into more than 20 different languages, is used in, I think, tertiary care clinics, university clinics primarily, as well as in research projects.
And when was it first published?
Oh, dear. It was first published in the first one in 1989, I believe. And then we revised it and published the revised version in 1994.
And you're also one of the authors of the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule. Is that also referred to as ADOS?
Yes.
Is that correct? Who are the other authors of ADOS?
Michael Rutter, Pamela DeLavor, who's a special educator from North Carolina, and Susan Reese, who is another clinical psychologist.
And what is ADOS?
The ADOS is a companion instrument to the ADIR, but which has actually been used because it's shorter and fits a particular clinic needs, it's now used independently as well. It's a standardized observation, so the idea is that the clinician works with a child or an adult for about 45 minutes, carrying out a standard series of activities. Different activities are available for different ages of kids and also different language levels. So you do different things if the child can talk very well than if the child can't talk at all, or you do different things with an adult than a teenager or a child. And the idea is that you create context for different kinds of social behavior. That is, by putting the child in a situation where they would likely want to request that you do something again, like blow bubbles, and then you look at how the child responds. And because it's standardized, you can then compare how do typical kids do this, how do children with intellectual disabilities who don't have autism do this, how do children with autism or autism spectrum disorders respond in these particular situations.
And who uses the ADOS?
It's used around the world by actually people from all kinds of disciplines.
Primarily for research, or is it also used in the clinic?
It's used a lot clinically as well as for research.
And have you authored any other diagnostic instruments?
I was also involved in creating a screening instrument, which is based on the ADIR, which is a series of questions really taken from the ADIR but modified slightly, with the idea of having a two-page form that parents could fill out that would allow you to screen for autism. And then I've also worked with a speech pathologist who's a collaborator in our very early intervention studies, looking at ways to define autism from coding videotapes of a general communication screening that she's developed.
And you've published over 125 articles related to child development and psychology. Does that sound about right?
Yes.
Are they all peer-reviewed?
I think those are, yeah.
And do the majority of them pertain to autism spectrum disorders?
Yeah.
Have you published specifically on regressive autism?
Yes.
In what way?
We've done a number of different papers about regression, looking at the different samples that we were studying, both the longitudinal sample, the kids from North Carolina and Chicago, and then also trying to pull together data from various collaborations to try to look at regression.
How long have you been looking at regression?
I think that we first started looking at it in the early longitudinal study, so that would have been around 1991-1992.
According to your CV, you've published 9 books. Is that accurate?
Yes.
And you've published 61 book chapters and other publications that pertain to child psychology, including autism spectrum disorders.
That's right.
Is that correct? And you currently serve on the editorial board of 6 child psychology and autism-related journals. Is that correct? And what does it mean to be on the editorial advisory board?
It means that you agree to review a lot of papers, that you agree to review a paper at least once a month for a journal, that you're identified as somebody who is a specialist in certain areas, so that if there are general discussions about where the journal is going next or conflicts, you will help sort them out.
And in the journals in which you serve, are they well-known in the field?
Yes.
Could you name a few?
Journal of Autism and Developmental Disorders, Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, Child Development, American Journal of Mental Retardation.
And are you a reviewer for any journals?
Yeah.
A lot?
Lots.
Have you ever testified before in a court of law?
Yes.
How many times?
I think 3 times.
And could you describe the cases?
I testified twice in cases involving parents accused through facilitated communication of abusing their children. So I testified in order to try to sort out the validity of these accusations for working with families. And then I've testified in a case case where a family was suing the state to try to get better services.
And why did you agree to testify for the U.S. government here today?
I felt like this is such an important question, and my expertise is limited in the sense that I'm an expert on behavior and development in autism and regression, but that is something that I've been working on for years. So I felt that it was important, since I was asked to come forward and be able to describe this, because so much time and energy and concern has gone into questions of the relationship between vaccines and autism.
Do parents in your clinic come to you with questions about vaccines and autism?
Almost every day.
And what do you tell them?
I tell them that at this point there is no evidence that vaccines cause autism, and so they need to really consider the fact that although it's very that everyone wants to find a cause, and that's a very emotional need, that at this point no one has been able to find any clear evidence that vaccines contribute to autism.
Now, before we get into the discussion of regression, you had mentioned that you conduct longitudinal studies. What is a longitudinal study?
A longitudinal study is a study that follows individuals over time. So as opposed to comparing a group of 2-year-olds and then a different group of 5-year-olds and a different group of 9-year-olds, a longitudinal study would identify children, or could be adults, at a particular age and then follow those same adults over time so that you can actually look at their development rather than make interpretations about development from pulling different people and comparing them because they happen to be different ages.
And how long does such a study usually last?
Well, it's difficult to do them because the way that funding works, at least in the federal government, is you tend to get 5-year grants. But I think that there are longitudinal studies in autism, and ours is probably the longest, where we've followed the kids now for 17 years. Our study of the toddlers has gone on for 3 years, and we hope we'll be able to follow those same kids longer.
Now, on page 2 of your report, you state that changes in behaviors associated with autism over time are predictable according to children's language level, social deficits, and the frequency and severity of their repetitive behaviors, as well as their parents' involvement in behavioral treatment. Could you just further explain what you mean by that statement?
That's a statement based on our longitudinal work. And what we did here was look at what were the characteristics of children at age 2 and at age 3 and at age 5, and look at things such as how much language did they have at 2, how much repetitive behavior did they have, judged both by our observations using the ADOS and also by their parent reports on the ADI and then also on other measures. And then what we tried to do was predict what would the children be like at age 9. Most of the analyses have consisted of saying, do the children still have autism? Do they have classic autism? Do they fall within the general area of autism spectrum disorders, PDD-NOS, or you could say Asperger syndrome? And then also, how well are they functioning? What's their language like? What are their nonverbal skills like at age 9? And so we were able to find particular factors that, when you looked at those factors, allowed you to make more accurate statements than if you just randomly guessed which children would still have autism, which children would fall within the realm of PDD-NOS or have milder characteristics on the basis of those features.
Dr. Lloyd, I'd like to now turn to a discussion of regression in autism. Does regression in autism exist?
Absolutely.
What is regression in autism?
Regression in autism is the phenomenon of children who have some skills that are observable and documentable over a period of time, who then don't produce those skills, either stop producing them or produce them at much less frequency. This is in autism, because of the way that autism has been defined, these regressions have typically occurred in the second year of life, maybe the end of the first year of life. In autism, typically we have not addressed later losses. For example, somebody changing during adolescence, but focused on those really early years. But there is quite a lot of research looking at these changes in these very early years.
And is regression confined just to autistic disorder proper, or is it found within any of the other spectrum disorders?
There are other disorders that are, and certainly other spectrum disorders. So in our research, we found that regression occurred both in children with classic autism and also children with PDD-NOS or milder phenomenon.
Is regression a new phenomenon?
No. Regression was first described many years ago, even by Lee O'Connor.
And when was it first described in the literature? Back in the 40s?
Yeah.
By Lee O'Connor. Okay. And how was it described back then?
It, it, the first ways in which regression was described, people tended to focus on the fact that children were described by their parents as having normal development and then losing skills. So I think those initial descriptions focused on that normal development, which I think now we don't think is the case and probably isn't the essence of regression. But I think that partly came from the fact that this was a new idea, and people were just noticing that there was an unusual pattern here.
How is regression assessed by a clinician or a researcher?
Yeah. The most typical way is by very careful interview of parents. So I think that there, because the regression involves two things, it involves having skills and then losing them, you have to have a very specific information about the skills that the child has in order to document what they've lost. And because there's huge variability, even in that narrow time period, say between 12 and 18 or 12 and 24 months, as to how many skills kids with autism spectrum disorders have, you need to very carefully determine what they could do, when they could do it, how specific those skills were, and then figure out what they can't do anymore. And then because many children start getting back some of those skills, you have to figure out where you are in that continuum. You know, are you at a point where the child is losing skills, is relatively stable, or gaining skills? That also differs across skills. So I think the primary method is a very detailed parent interview.
And are there certain particular questions that must be asked of the parents?
Right. If you don't ask parents specific information, you often won't get it, because parents are filled with information but often don't know what's relevant or don't know, you know, what you're thinking about.
Does it also depend on how the question is asked, how it's phrased to the parent?
Absolutely.
And what skills are typically lost in regression?
We used to think that the primary way that we should define regression was loss of words. But it's become apparent through the research that we've done and a number of other people have done that what's most common is loss of social skills. And in fact, in our study of toddlers right now, we found that the majority of children who develop autism actually lose social skills. So in fact, if you define regression by loss of social skills, almost all children with autism show a pretty marked, documentable loss of certain social skills, such as eye contact, attending to people, engaging in social interaction in the course of that second year of life from 12 months to 24 months.
What are the skills that are typically first recognized by parents as a sign of regression?
Kids who stop talking. Kids who may have had social routines like peekaboo or waving or going so big who stopped doing that. Kids seeking their parents out, so wanting to find people to play with or to be engaged in. Smiling, sort of general positive affect. Understanding sort of little jokes, being able to catch a child's eye and make a face at them and have them respond.
Now, in your report, you say regressions in autism follow a predictable pattern. Could you explain what you mean by that?
The point there is not that all children are the same, but there does seem to be a pattern in which children are acquiring skills, and then this acquisition slows down. So that the sort of prototypical example would be a child who at 12 months says mama, dada, baby, maybe the name of their sister. And if you go through a list with the parent retroactively of here's 25 things that most 12-month-olds can do, that child may not do all 25 things. I mean, actually, probably nobody does all 25 things. But they might do 18 of those things. And then what happens is that the child doesn't progress. So they may have those few words, but for months they don't acquire new words, and perhaps those words begin to appear less frequently. Then there comes a time where the child stops talking completely or will only say mama but doesn't say those other words, and at the same time has become socially less engaged, so may spend more time by themselves, may develop odd behaviors, may become attached to a banana peel or suddenly want to do sticks or become fascinated with buttons on the television. So there you have this combination of having skills, you know, and being on a trajectory of developing things, slowing down for a while, not seeming to acquire many more skills, and then some of those skills just sort of fading out. The trouble is that also at the same time, the child may be developing some other good skills. So in our study where we're watching kids every month, we've been able to see that at the same time, some things are getting worse, often other things are getting better. And they're, you know, the children are not on timers. So it's not like everyone does something at 12 months, 13 months, 14 months. You may have some children who slow down at 13 months and then start developing, you know, good skills at 15 months, and other kids who are still slowing down at 14 months. So the trajectories are similar. That is, you can literally draw lines that look quite similar, but they're spaced out and the timing is shifts, you know, not in a huge amount, but definitely over a 6 to 8 month period.
So are all regressions the same?
No, I mean, because partly you're talking about, in order to define a regression, you can only lose what you've already got. So a lot of this depends on what was the child able to do before this process started, where they slow down and begin to lose skills. And there's huge variability. There are some kids with autism who never wave goodbye, you know, or don't wave goodbye in the first 2 years of life, just don't figure out how to do that, so they can't lose it. Other kids who may learn how to do this and lose it. Other kids who may learn how to wave and keep waving but may stop talking. So it's almost like you have this constellation of skills. Again, that list of, you know, 25 things. And there are similar patterns, but nobody is exactly the same. The timing is different and the specific skills vary considerably in terms of which of those are lost, in part because they vary which of them are gained.
Do autistic children who have regression typically lose motor skills as well?
No.
What about autistic children in general? Do they lose motor skills typically?
Not very often.
What has research shown to be the main component of regression in autism?
The main component of regression is loss of social communication. So I think that we had initially focused on word loss because it's much more reliably reported. That is, if you ask parents years later what happened in your child's early development, you know, mothers and fathers agree with each other more about loss of words than they do about social skills. But I think that when we've had detailed studies that have asked more carefully about social communication skills, it's apparent that there are more kids who lose social skills than there are who lose words. And that loss of social skills is probably in the long run more characteristics of autism than just word loss.
And is regression a gradual process or a precipitous process? Is it an either or?
Yeah, it's not an either or, because I think that it's, as I said, it's we're talking about a moving target. I mean, loss of skills, loss of social skills is more the norm in autism than the exception. So if we describe kids as having a regression, who go from looking at people to some degree when they're 9 months old to looking at people less often by the time they're 15 months old, then probably almost all children with autism would have a regression. If we set our threshold higher and say you can't have a regression unless you've had 20 of those social skills and lost 15 of them, then we get a much smaller number.
Has your research found that regression is always characterized by a very clear decline or loss of skills?
No.
Do children who lose words as part of their autistic regression ever regain language?
Yes, most of them do.
What language level do they typically reach?
Well, our research suggests that the language levels that the kids who have a regression reach are very similar to kids who haven't had regression. There seems like in our study, there's a slight downward skewing. That is, the kids who have had regressions come out with about a 10-point lower score in verbal IQ when you look at them years later than kids who didn't have a regression. One other study found the same thing we did, and several other studies have found no difference.
Is there a typical duration of time between word loss and regaining language skills?
No, there's a huge variability, and that's another important aspect in the definition of regression is how long do you have to have lost skills before you officially have a regression? When we interviewed parents of two-year-olds, we found kids who had lost skills for a month and then started regaining them, as well as kids who stopped talking and actually never talked again or started talking, you know, months later or years later. So there is a huge range, and that probably also confounds trying to figure out what regression is, because parents have different memories about a child who didn't talk for a month than a child who had five words and then never spoke again.
Do children with autism in general improve?
Absolutely.
What percentage do you know?
I mean, I think all children with autism improve in some ways, and how much is highly variable.
Would that include children who have a regression in autism? Do they improve as well?
Yes.
Do we know why?
No. I mean, some of the improvement seems to be getting back on developmental course. I mean, it's like asking, why do normal kids learn to do the things that they do? We can describe how they learn things, but that process of, you know, how do kids learn to walk or talk when no one is really teaching them, we don't know. And that's the same for autism. We know that, behavioral treatments make some difference, but it's a relatively small amount of difference compared to just that force of development.
You talked about the majority of children who have suffered a loss of words regain some level of language. Do they also improve in their social skills?
Yes. I mean, not with language, you have some children who regain language and are as fluent as any of the rest of us. Not a huge number, but that definitely happens. In social development, it would be very rare for a child to not have some kind of residual social deficit, but that also happens with kids who had regressions or kids who didn't, in a very small proportion of kids with autism.
Is autism in general associated with any particular ethnic group?
No.
What about regressive autism? Any particular ethnic group association?
No.
Is regressive autism associated with any particular social class?
No.
Any particular gender?
No.
Any particular birth order?
No.
If an autistic child has regression and lost skills, does that mean that the child was developing entirely typically before the regression?
No. I mean, I think that's one of the most important things that the research has figured out, that just because you have a loss doesn't mean that things were normal to begin with. They're actually different factors. They're not independent, because obviously you can't have a loss if you didn't have some skills. So a child who was developing very, very slowly and had very limited skills would be less likely to have a loss because they don't have as many skills to lose. But given that most children had some skills, that presence of a loss does not mean that things were normal to begin with. And it's very clear from many research studies in the last 10 years that most children who had losses showed deficits prior to that loss. So the loss is not an indication of normality or abnormality. It's a separate question.
Have you ever heard of the term clearly regressive autism?
No.
Is that term discussed in the published literature anywhere?
Not that I know of.
Doctor, is there a distinct phenotype among people with autism who had completely normal development during the first year of life and then suffer a regression in the second year of life?
I don't think so.
Is a review of pediatric records during the first year of life a reliable way to assess whether or not that child was developing entirely typically during that time period?
No. I mean, if you had a pediatric record that indicated concerns, you would certainly take that seriously. But to have a pediatric record that doesn't mention anything, you have no idea if the pediatrician didn't ask, if the parents said something and the pediatrician didn't happen to record it, or if the parent raised a concern and the pediatrician ignored it. So the absence of information, the absence of abnormality in a pediatric record without very systematic questioning means nothing.
Are pediatricians usually attuned to subtle abnormalities that later manifest as autism?
They're getting better, but in the past, that has been a major complaint of parents, is that pediatricians don't necessarily see that or take seriously the kinds of difficulties that their children have.
Are parental accounts of typical development during the first year of life an accurate measure of a child's development during that time?
I think parents' accounts are the best source of information we have. I mean, with the advent of videos, we also have videos, which have made a huge difference as well. But people don't necessarily video their children in all sorts of situations, and they don't do it systematically. They don't say, I'm going to always video my child, you know, every Monday taking a bath and every Tuesday eating a meal. So I think parents are our primary source of information. The problem is that what you get depends on what you ask. And it also, parent reports are affected by memory. So you will get quite different reports sometimes if you ask parents of six-year-olds versus asking parents of two-year-olds what they are. So that they're not, they're flawed, but I think they are our best source of information.
Doctor, I'd like to turn our attention to the Rischler study, which is filed as Respondents Master List 397. Are you familiar with this study?
Yes.
Were you one of the authors of this study?
Yes.
What was your responsibility with regard to this study?
I was the PI for carrying out this study, and I supervised...
What's a PI?
Principal Investigator. So I was responsible for this study, and the person who was first author who did the initial draft was a graduate student of mine, and I worked with her to gather the data, analyze the data, and write up the interpretation.
And what did this study investigate?
This study looked at whether we could find a clear regressive phenotype of autism. That is, we were trying to take descriptions that had come out of previous research and see if there was some validity to them and whether this phenotype was related to the MMR vaccination.
And how long did the study take to compile?
The study used existing data, so that we took data from a number of sites around the country that were all involved in different research projects, but where we'd all decided to use the same methods to diagnose autism and to describe the children with autism. So those studies had been going on for about 5 years, and then we took existing data, cleaned it up, which took about a year, and then did follow-up interviews and organized the other sites to do follow-up interviews of children identified in that data set. That probably took another 2 years. And then analyzed the data and wrote it up.
And how did you investigate whether regression is a distinct phenotype within autism?
What we did was try to take the major principles that people have used to define, to suggest that there are, that there is a special group of children with autism who have regression and that those children are different from other children with autism. And at the time, we really started with the hypothesis that they were different and that we wanted to see how they were different. And so what we did was define regression. So in that study, we defined regression by having a loss of words. But then we also had very systematic questions about loss of social development. And it turned out, over the course of this study, that children who lost social skills were not different from children who lost words and social skills, and that almost all of the children who lost words also lost social skills. We then looked at various aspects of those children's development in terms of their acquisition of the social skills before the loss, and compared them to typically developing children, and then we looked at different characteristics such as the existence of GI symptoms and things like gender, ethnicity, birth order, to see if there was something special about those kids who'd had these losses.
And did you find any differences?
We did not find much. We found minor differences in the outcome in terms of verbal IQ, that is, children who'd had a regression were slightly lower, about 10 points, which is a real difference, but not huge at later ages. And we found a slightly higher frequency of parents' reports of diarrhea and constipation in the children who had had regressions.
You said that you started with the hypothesis that there was a difference between regression and non-regression. Why did you start with that hypothesis?
Well, I think we had heard about regression for years from parents that we worked with. We had seen children, especially siblings of children, so we would know a child with autism and then meet a sibling who people thought was typical, and then watched that child become autistic. So I think we were starting from the point of view that we wanted to be sure that people didn't dismiss regression and as if it didn't exist. And then, I mean, regression is a very striking phenomenon. To watch a child gradually become autistic is a heartbreaking situation and something that's very hard to forget. So we were interested in what does this mean, and also a question of are the children who experience this different in some way to children who don't? What we found out is that there isn't a cut and dried regression, non-regression. There are these continua of changes, some of which seem to happen for almost all children with autism, and some of which don't. And the more we looked, the less we found that was very clear.
What did you find with regard to the regressive group's development before they had a loss of skills?
We found that most of the children who were identified as having regression, when you went through parents and ask them, could your children do this prior to age 2, were actually behind before the regression had occurred.
Were there children who appeared to have near typical development prior to the loss of skills?
There were children whose parents reported that they had more skills, so that if you just added up the number of these different social skills, there were children who had regressions who had the same number of social skills as a typical
child. Did those children fit the lower IQ, the diarrhea profile that you found with the other children who had it?
No, they didn't. So we didn't find any clustering of the characteristics that people had suggested might define this regressive subtype. As we found, we did find minor differences in GI. We did find that there were kids who had more skills, but we didn't find that they went together.
Now, you mentioned that this study also considered whether autistic regression was associated with the MMR vaccine. Was that a...
That's right.
And what did you conclude?
We could not find any relationship between between regression, or when we defined this group and said, well, if there is a regressive phenotype, this is who other researchers would have said would be in it. We couldn't find any relationship between that and having an MMR vaccine.
Doctor, does the Rischler study support the notion that there is a distinct phenotype in autism known as regressive autism?
No.
Had you ever heard the term regressive autism back when you were first looking at the phenomenon?
I think my first exposure to the term regressive autism was as it was applied to the work of Andrew Wakefield and the MMR vaccine.
Before that work, how is it described or considered by the autistic community?
Before that, I think that most researchers felt like regression is one variable in looking at early development.
Does any of your research or research of others support a distinct subtype of regressive autism?
No. I mean, I think especially as we've looked at the toddlers, it becomes, you know, as we look at the toddlers, it's clear that even these very large studies where we felt like we were asking parents many, many questions in great detail probably do not get at the essence of what happens in those early months because the changes are more subtle and our ability to observe them is so much dependent on the context. It's depending on when do you see a child and what are you looking for. So I think that that has moved us and I think much of the field toward a sense that there isn't a regression or not a regression. There's the question is the degree and type of worsening that occurs, how long it lasts, and how many skills a child has before that occurs.
Now, in terms of the clinical outcome of a 5 or 6-year-old with autism, is there any marked difference in the clinical outcome of a child who had what I'll term early onset autism versus a child who did indeed have regression?
Most studies have found no difference at all. The studies that have found differences have found these relatively small differences in verbal skills.
Now you touched on earlier, Doctor, that you're continuing to research the phenomenon of regression. Is that correct?
That's right.
And you're conducting a longitudinal study. Is that correct?
That's right.
And what information is emerging from that study with regard to regression?
With that study, what we've been doing is seeing children who are at risk for having autism either because they have a sibling with autism. So they may not have any behaviors associated with autism, but they have a sibling and their parents are eager to have somebody follow them, or there something has occurred or something has been seen, often identified by parents, but sometimes by physicians, pediatricians. For example, a child's had seizures in the first year of life, and so someone is concerned that this child might develop autism. And we see the children once a month, have parents fill out the same forms each month, and then we do a standardized assessment, a toddler version of the ADOS. So we do a standardized observation of the child's social behavior with us and with the parents every month. What has come out of this is that the trajectories are much less clear than we would have thought from retrospective descriptions years later of what the children are like. And when we have tried to sort that out, I think that there are a number of implications. One is that different skills are changing at different rates and at different times, so that you have, for example, eye contact is typically getting worse for almost all of the children from 12 months to 24 months. So that, and social engagement, the responsiveness to somebody trying to get the child to interact with them, both us and their parents, typically is getting worse in children who have autism diagnoses, say, by the time they're 2.5. So those things are changing, but they actually cycle back around. So they get worse for a while, and then for some children, they start getting better again. We also have other skills, for example, a response to joint attention, a response to somebody pointing or trying to get the child to look at something. And that, for a number of kids, gradually gets better, even at the same time that some of these social skills are getting worse. So I think what we've realized that this is, it's just much more complicated changes in development than we thought. And that these things that we used to think only happened in kids who had regressions are actually happening in almost everybody who has autism. Because There are some children who look very different from typical children at 12 months. But those are few and far between. And in fact, in our follow-up study, that isn't necessarily predictive. The kids who are not making eye contact at 12 months are not the most autistic kids at age 3. So many things change during that toddler period. And I think that our conceptualizations of what regression is are partly based on retroactive trying to figure out what happened and didn't happen, which is quite different than when we can see it happening right before our very eyes.
Doctor, are you aware of any evidence showing that the etiology of regression in autism is different than that from non-regression,
no,
for lack of a better word?
And I think, again, the idea that there aren't these clear patterns makes it much harder to draw conclusions about etiology, because basically you could arbitrarily divide these kids up in millions of different ways. So far, no matter, people have tried to divide them up and haven't found any differences in etiology, but it's not even clear that we know how to divide them up, or they can be divided up.
Doctor, before this litigation, had you ever read in any published literature that thimerosal-containing vaccines cause regressive autism only?
I had not.
Are you aware of any study that has ever suggested that hypothesis?
No.
Doctor, did you review the report submitted by Dr. Marcel Kinsborn in this litigation?
Yes.
On page 14 of his report, he states that the late onset of the regressive subtype and the subsequent remission or relapses become more understandable if autism is due to disease than if it is the aftermath of congenital maldevelopment. Do you agree with this statement?
No.
Why not?
There are many different disorders where onset occurs later on. I mean, we have Huntington's disease and schizophrenia and sickle cell anemia and all kinds of disorders that children where we, in some cases, we know are genetic, but which occur later on. So I think we can't make a simple inference that because something emerges later, that means that somehow someone has caught a disease or had some kind of particular environmental event that caused it.
And Dr. Kinsborn also draws a distinction between what he terms as classical or congenital autism and regressive autism. Is this a proper distinction?
I think the term congenital autism means nothing because as I said, it's a developmental process. We can't diagnose autism in a brand new baby. And so in all cases, something is developing that would lead us into autism. So to make this distinction between congenital and regressive is a false dichotomy.
Now, Dr. Kinsborn has also described what he terms his over-arousal model as an explanation for autistic behavior. Does his over-arousal model accurately describe what is known about autistic behavior?
I don't believe so. I mean, the over-arousal model has been around for 40 or 50 years and used to describe many different disorders. I think one of the hard things is that it becomes very circular. Children with autism do respond to being overstimulated, as do many other kids. And children with autism may respond in more conspicuous ways and may have a lower threshold. But the problem is that often the behaviors that are used to say that a child is responding by over-arousal, for example, flapping or getting very physically excited or distracted, are the same behaviors that occur when a child is under-aroused. We can get children who have a lot of self-stimulatory behaviors, to do these behaviors by putting them in a situation where there's nothing to do. We also see children do those behaviors when they're very happy or when they're not so happy. So the behaviors that are used to define over-arousal are behaviors that occur in many different contexts.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Ready to proceed?
Yes, ma'am. Good morning, Dr. Lord. Go ahead and refill the water there. My name is Tom Powers, along with Mr. Williams at the table with me. We represent the two families here as well as the petitioner's steering committee. I do have some questions to ask you, as you might imagine, based on the report that you filed and the testimony you gave today. Your testimony, as I understand it, and your opinion is that there's no phenotype for regressive autism, or perhaps a more specific way to put that is that regression in autism is not a distinct phenotype within autism spectrum disorder. Is that correct?
Yes.
You've also described regression in autistic children as a striking phenomenon. Do you remember that testimony?
Yes.
What is the difference between a phenotype and a striking phenomenon? How would you describe the difference between phenotype and striking phenomenon?
My point about the striking phenomenon is that it is a remarkable experience to watch a child who has been able to do things not be able to do those things, or to watch a child who has been relatively socially engaged become less engaged and be more and more difficult to engage or attract. But I think that is different than a phenotype, because a phenotype implies that there are a cluster of behaviors that are associated with each other, and that there's something unique about that cluster of behaviors. I think regression is a real phenomenon in autism, but there's a continuum of regression. It's not, and we can create a phenotype. I can say, well, I'm only putting kids who lost words into this group, and I'm going to call it the Lord phenotype, but there has been nobody has been able to show that phenotype is associated with anything other than the characteristics which I use to define the phenotype.
And that would be because, as I understand it, autism diagnostically is entirely a symptomatic diagnosis. That is, it's not a biomarker. There's no underlying pathology that one would use typically. Is that correct?
It's not. The problems with defining the phenotype aren't because autism is defined purely by behavior. It's because we haven't been able to find an association between any of these particular phenotypes that people have pulled out and the ways in which people have pulled out the phenotype.
Now, the autism diagnosis typically covers three domains. There's the communication skills, social reciprocity, and play and behavioral skills. Is that correct?
That's right.
I heard a significant amount of your testimony on direct focused on the social reciprocity and the communication domains. I didn't hear a lot of discussion about the play. Mm-hmm. In your work on regression, do you have an idea of what percentage of children who have regression regressed in the area of play and appropriate play?
That's a good question. There's probably less loss of play because many children at the time the losses occur are not playing very much. I mean, it partly depends on how you define play. If you define play in terms of social play, then in fact you do have regressions, and that would fall under what I was talking about before, like peekaboo and patty cake. I mean, those aspects of play. If you're talking about play as using toys or using materials, that when you're looking at a 15-month-old with autism, many children are not using materials in a terribly useful way. So there's less loss than you would see in the other areas.
And that actually is the type of play that my question was designed to get to. Not sort of the social reciprocity play, but using toys appropriately. So if you have tools, you actually use them as tools, or if you have trains, you actually use them as trains. In thinking of that kind of play, are you aware of any studies that demonstrate children who reached a point where they were playing with toys in a functionally appropriate way, who then lost those skills and played with those same toys in non-typical ways?
I'm trying to remember. In our studies of the toddlers, we do document changes in play. What we do see is an increasing amount over this period of time of non-functional play. So I think one of the things we really don't know is the degree to which is the child might be losing sort of imaginative play versus gaining repetitive behaviors that are more attractive to them. So if you think about a child who's got a car and they're pushing it back and forth, a parent may think, and we would probably think the same thing, that they're doing something imaginative if you start with that. What is more typical of the changes over time is that a child may move from moving that car a little bit to then wanting to line up a number of different cars. And that is typical, actually, of children that we've seen, both who've had losses and who have not had losses.
Do you have a sense in sort of the larger picture of things, what percentage of children in this area of normal development preceding loss, I think is the descriptive phrase you use. If you look at the number of children who do have regression, what percentage of those children do you believe actually were normal, neurotypical, in the period of time preceding their loss?
I don't think we can make a distinction. I mean, I don't think we can divide kids up as to normal and abnormal. I think what we have to do is think about how many skills they had before the autism became apparent. And I think there are some kids who have quite a few social communication skills before autism became apparent, and other kids who had fewer. But I don't think that it's probably of much value to try to say who's normal and who's not normal, because we're making all these inferences retroactively. And some of it's going to depend on parent reporting, how much parents knew, and the way in which the questions are asked.
And did you hear the testimony of Dr. Rust when he appeared?
No.
Well, Dr. Rust described that within the children that he sees, the ones that are reported to be regressive, he actively does this retrospective analysis and attempts to identify earlier in time, earlier symptoms that might have been missed. And he testified that in about 20% of his described regressive autistic patients, he cannot find anything abnormal in their early development. So that he described basically the answer as 20%. Is that answer consistent with your experience that perhaps 20% of children who regress, even retrospectively, show no abnormal signs of early development?
I don't know.
One of the issues in this litigation, and as you're probably aware, is discussing the causes of autism. Now, you would agree that genetics are a significant contributing factor to the development of autism?
Yes.
And that heritability is something that is distinctive in one is evaluating the etiology of autism spectrum disorders.
I think that we have to make a distinction between heritability and genetics. So it seems very likely that there are genetic components to autism. That is, genetics contributes to your risk of having autism. Whether the degree to which that's inherited, that is that you actually, it's passed from family member to family member versus it's something that happens in very early points of conception, which changes your genes, I think we don't know. I mean, yeah.
Well, in a lot of the testimony we've heard, one of the big issues is this focus on genetic contributors and looking at concordance rates, particularly in twin studies. Are you familiar with the concordance studies involving both monozygotic and dizygotic twins?
Yes.
And you would agree that the high concordance rates reported in those studies is evidence that there's a strong genetic component in autism, correct?
Yes.
Now, in your report on page 3, you describe that regressions are not concordant within families, correct?
That's right.
So if regression cases of autism are non-concordant within families, that would suggest something other than a heritability factor involved in the etiology of those cases, correct?
I should be clear that the paper that I was citing is a paper that is was presented for a PhD dissertation, which has lately become quite controversial. So I'm not sure now what that means.
Well, all I'm saying is you cited it in your report for the proposition that regressions are not concordant within families. That's what you cited for. So are you saying now that you've changed your opinion on this issue since writing your report?
I'm saying that I don't know, that I would not say that over again.
Is there anything else in your report that you would reconsider in light of recent evidence?
I don't think so.
But if it's true that autism is not concordant among regressive cases, that would strongly suggest that there are other non-genetic factors involved, correct?
Not necessarily. I think the point there was that regression isn't a yes or no phenomenon. I mean, in fact, while autism spectrum disorders are concordant within twins, that is, if you have one twin, the chances of an identical twin having something within the range of autism, the narrow definition of autism is not concordant. So you can have twins, identical twins, where one child is very severely autistic and intellectually disabled and nonverbal, and another child who has very mild, subtle difficulties. So whatever is concordant isn't this kind of autism or that kind of autism. So it wouldn't be surprising if the developmental pattern is not concordant as well, since we know that things like IQ are not necessarily concordant within twins. So it doesn't mean that it's not genetic. It just means that whatever is genetic about autism is a risk factor for this very broad kind of problem.
And it's a risk factor that makes one at risk for a whole host of non-heritable, non-genetic factors, correct?
We don't know.
Well, if it's not heritable and genetic, it would have to be something else, correct? I'm not asking you to name what it is, but it simply would have to be something else, correct?
But I guess I'm not saying I don't know if all of autism is heritable. I think the question is, I mean, it could be that it's not inherited by, it's not through a particular gene, but it's a combination of other genes that actually don't have anything to do with autism, except they affect the way that the child learns.
And they would affect those various genetic permutations mm-hmm. within an individual would affect the way that they respond to environmental stimuli, whether it's a learning experience or environmental exposures to substances, correct?
We don't know.
I understand that we don't know, but that is one of the etiologies that one would have to look at in attempting to describe what caused a particular case of autism, correct?
Yes.
Now, in your role sitting on this NIH Strategic Planning Committee, did you participate in the 2007 IOM Environmental Factors in Autism Workshop?
No, this committee didn't exist then.
So this committee was formed after that?
Yes.
Is the committee that you're sitting on currently evaluating any of the research suggestions or research proposals that were generated in that 2007 IOM meeting?
The committee that I'm sitting on doesn't evaluate proposals. The committee that I'm sitting on just tries to look at what directions federal funding should take in the future.
Is one of the directions that your committee is considering spending federal research dollars to look at potential environmental factors that influence the development of autism?
Yes.
Are you involved with the NIEHS expert panel that was convened in 2006?
No.
Are you in the work that you're doing now, are you considering the NIEHS expert panel recommendations on additional research that could be done, particularly within the vaccine safety data link, to start explicating the various causes of autism? Are you involved in any of that work?
The committee that I'm on is looking, again, it's much broader, so it's not at a level at all of looking at specific proposals.
If not looking at specific proposals, are you looking at general proposals coming out of that NIEHS workshop to look at environmental contributions to autism?
We're not even looking at general proposals.
Okay. In describing the role of vaccines in autism, you described the Rickler study in some detail. That was a study that focused on the MMR. Is that correct?
That study was, yes. I mean, yes.
Are there Are there any other studies that are published right now that look, as far as you know, at an association between thimerosal-containing vaccines and the regressive features of autism, specifically looking at regression?
Not that I know.
Are you aware of any that are ongoing, let alone published?
I'm aware that there are studies on thimerosal, but that's the level of my familiarity.
The longitudinal study that you were working on, that you had some, it sounded like anecdotal interim data, is that correct?
That's right.
So the findings of the longitudinal study have not yet been peer-reviewed?
That's right.
Are they in the form of a manuscript that is about to be peer-reviewed or submitted for publication?
Yes.
When do you anticipate that that's going to be submitted for peer review?
Sometime in the next couple months.
And upon submission, it would then be peer-reviewed, but up until now, this is sort of an anecdotal report on preliminary findings, correct? Is this study NIH-funded?
Parts of it, yes.
You've mentioned that in a large number of cases using this retrospective search, so to speak, for pre-regression normalcy, you've said that the more you look, the more signs that one tends to see. Is that correct?
The more signs of
non-normal,
yes,
pre-regressive development. But you certainly don't see the lack of normalcy or latent abnormality in all pre-regressive cases, correct?
No.
I have no further questions.
Redirect.
Dr. Lord, Mr. Powers asked you to spend a lot of time discussing genetics and autism. Are you a geneticist?
No.
Okay. Do you claim to be?
No.
Okay. He also asked you about the NIH committee that you sit on that's looking at environmental factors in autism.
Yes. I mean, the NIH committee that I'm sitting on is looking at trying to set priorities for federal funding related to autism across practice, across research that affects everything from practice to looking for etiology.
Okay. He also asked you a bunch of questions about the type of play that is indicative of a loss. And he distinguished between playing with toys as opposed to social play. Mm-hmm. Is this a way to define a phenotype?
Many people describe play in autism as part of assessments. It turns out that using it as a way of defining the phenotype has not been very helpful because there's such variability both between or among kids with autism but also typical kids. So the reality is that most typical kids can use an object to pretend that it's something else by the time they're 18 months old. But whether they'll do that in any 45-minute interval or the amount of time that they spend doing that is hugely variable from kids who don't have a lot of imaginative play and spend much more time running around or in social play and kids who are, you know, making toothbrushes into dolls, you know, from very early ages. So it turns out that it's a very interesting phenomenon, but it hasn't been very useful in terms of defining phenotypes.
And is the change in the way one plays with toys a characteristic, the most characteristic loss, type of skill lost in regression?
No.
Now, you were asked us a couple questions about the Rischler study and whether it focused on MMR. Was that the only point of the study?
No. The point of the study that's written up in the Rischler paper, which is also written up in several other papers, was to see if we could get consistent descriptions of regression across these 10 different sites around the country. So it was really to say, you know, can we verify that regressions occurred using standardized measures that where everyone is asking the families from these different research projects the same questions.
And Mr. Powers also referred to your ongoing longitudinal studies, and he termed your findings anecdotal. Doctor, are you describing your findings in that study and your opinions here today? Are you basing those on anecdotal evidence or on your experience?
Well, it's not anecdotal evidence in the sense that we have 50 children who have autism spectrum disorders whom we've followed in a very systematic way over the last 3 years. So I'm not just describing one child that I've seen. It's data that's been analyzed by a team of people, what we have not done yet is finalize a manuscript that's been sent off for peer review.
Thank you.
We cross?
A couple of just very quick questions. Doctor, in getting back to this issue that Ms. Riccadella was talking about, the repetitive, the play areas and the different domains, do you have a sense what percentage of regressive cases demonstrate a loss of skills across all three developmental domains? Do you have an idea?
Well, from the toddler study, the study where we are following kids, there are different patterns across those areas of skill. And they're actually, even within an area, there are different patterns. So there are, so that certain losses of skill are very common and others are much less common. Again, partly because you can't lose a skill till you have it. I don't have a sense of, well, I also think that in play, the issue often isn't just loss of skill, it's the beginning of repetitive behavior. And so it's very hard to sort out what's lost and what something else is being acquired that supersedes the thing that's there.
So would a fair answer to that question then that you just aren't able to put a percentage on the number of cases of regression in which lost, acquired skills are lost in all three domains?
That is something I could probably look at the data that we have and figure out, but I can't do it in my head.
And it's not anything that you've analyzed for publication, and there's not any data that we'd be able to look at right now to be able to make that percentage?
Not right at this minute.
Okay. And finally, did you review the medical records of either of the individual childs?
No.
Were you asked to do that by anybody?
No.
No further questions.
One follow-up for that. Mr. Powers again asked you about the current study and whether or not you're able to come up with percentages based on data collected over the past few years. Doctor, your opinions in this case based on data that you've collected over the past 4 years or your experience over the past 35 years?
Yeah. I mean, the toddler study, which I'm alluding to, is just a small part of what I'm talking about. So mostly what I've been talking about has been the research that's been conducted prior to that study.
Thank you.
Questions from my colleagues? Dr. Lord, I have no questions for you. Mr. Powers, did you have any follow-up to that last question? I wanted to get our questions in before we asked you.
Yeah, well, the last time that happened, I was jumping up too early, but no, I have no further questions. Thank you.
Then Dr. Lord, you're excused. I take it is Dr. Fombonis present? Do you need a brief? It's a good time to take our morning recess, and my watch says it's 25 after 10, so how about we reconvene at 20 to 11?